Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a subject that, well, it underpins a huge part of our economy, Wisconsin insurance law.
Mm.
Our main guide for this is the Intermediary's Guide to Wisconsin Insurance Law, the 33rd edition from August 2024.
Right. And, you know, while it's definitely key for people studying for their insurance exams, it's actually packed with really valuable insights for anyone just wanting to get a clearer picture of the insurance regulations here in Wisconsin.
Exactly. And I should mention, for you folks who want the full, raw detail.
Yeah, the really deep stuff.
You can always grab the complete Wisconsin Administrative Code and statutes. They're available right from the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance. That's oci.yebui.gov, or the Department of Administration.
Absolutely. Think of our deep dive today as kind of navigating that big landscape for you, hitting the highlights, the most critical pieces.
That's the plan. Our mission today is really to boil down the essence of Wisconsin insurance regulation. We'll be looking at the Commissioner of Insurance, their role, their powers, which are pretty significant.
Oh, yeah. Then we'll get into what it takes to be an insurance intermediary, the licensing responsibilities.
Uh-huh. The nuts and bolts.
And in the contracts themselves, the key rules around those. Plus, we'll touch on different insurance types, including those mandatory risk-sharing plans.
Right. So it's a curated path, basically, to understanding the rules.
Perfect way to put it. Okay, let's unpack this, starting right at the top with the Commissioner of Insurance.
Okay. So the Commissioner, they really hold a central spot. They're responsible for, well, both administering and enforcing all the insurance laws in Wisconsin.
Administering and enforcing. Got it.
And what's interesting is the law actually expects the office to act promptly.
Promptly. So no slow bureaucratic pace here.
Not supposed to be. No, it's not an area where, you know, regulatory lag is seen as the norm.
Okay. It's not just about speed, right? The guide says the commissioner and the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance have pretty significant powers.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about the power to adopt rules, issue different kinds of orders. Orders, like telling people what not to do.
Yeah, those are prohibitory orders.
Yeah.
But also mandatory orders, telling them what they must do.
Uh-huh.
And even declaratory orders.
Declaratory. What's that mean exactly?
It basically clarifies rights and responsibilities under the law when things might be ambiguous.
Ah, I see. Like if there's a new kind of insurance product.
Exactly. Maybe something digital, niche, and nobody's quite sure how the existing rules apply.
Right.
An insurer or even a consumer group could ask the commissioner for a declaratory order to get clarity.
Okay, so it provides a kind of regulatory compass. That makes sense. Now, issuing these orders, especially if there's a hearing involved, it sounds like they have to follow specific procedures.
Yes, absolutely. The statutory administrative procedures have to be met. They can't just issue orders arbitrarily, especially if it involves a formal hearing. Due process is key.
Got it. The commissioner can also demand information, right? It sounds like pretty much anyone regulated intermediaries, insurers, could get a request.
That's right. The commissioner has the authority to require reports, statements, answers to questionnaires from various persons under regulation.
And it's more than just asking politely.
Definitely. For specific people, officers, managers, agents of insurers, and licensed intermediaries themselves, there's a legal obligation to reply promptly in writing to any formal written inquiry from the commissioner.
And if they don't?
There can be penalties.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when the commissioner asks formally, a quick response is really important.
Okay. So they can ask for info, but what if they need to dig deeper? Can they investigate?
Oh, yeah. Beyond just requesting info, the commissioner has broad examination powers.
Examination power.
Right.
Does that just mean looking at licensed companies?
No, it's actually broader. It covers licensees, sure, but also applicants for licenses and even entities just organizing to start an insurance business.
Wow. Okay.
The goal is to get a full picture relevant to enforcing the laws. And they don't just launch these exams randomly.
Right, they consider things.
Yeah, factors like how long the company's been around, how long they've had their Wisconsin license, the specifics of their business, their record keeping, even findings from other regulators.
Makes sense, kind of a risk-based approach. And isn't there a mandatory part to this too, some exams they have to do?
Yes, that's right. The commissioner is legally required to examine every domestic insurer that's an insurer based right here in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And also every license rate service organization. It's an ongoing duty.
So if you're the one being examined, what's expected? Total transparency.
Pretty much. You have to make all your relevant accounts, records, documents, any evidence available to the commissioner.
All of it.
And this goes for related entities, too, in what they call collateral examinations. If you don't comply, it could be seen as concealment of records.
Which sounds serious.
It is.
Yeah.
Could even lead to liquidation of the business.
Yikes. But what if you genuinely can't get records from, say, a third party?
There's a provision for that. If you can show you really can't get the info, and you immediately take steps to end your relationship with that uncooperative party,
okay,
then it won't automatically be considered concealment. You have to show you tried.
That's a bit of a safety valve. Now, these examinations must cost something. Who pays?
It depends. For domestic insurers, the costs are actually pooled.
Pooled?
Yeah, and then divided up among all the domestic insurers based on the premiums they write in the state.
Interesting. What about others?
For insurers based outside Wisconsin, or town mutual insurers, the company being examined usually pays the reasonable costs directly.
Unless
the commissioner decides that would be an unreasonable financial burden. Also, pre-licensing schools and continuing ed providers can get billed for their exam costs.
So costs cover salaries, travel, all that.
Exactly. Anything directly related to the examination.
And the commissioner's reach isn't just limited to the insurance entities themselves.
No, it's quite broad. They can do those collateral examinations of related companies, parent companies, subsidiaries, you name it. And crucially, the OCI can access records from any state agency or political subdivision in Wisconsin.
So they can really get a comprehensive view if needed.
Definitely. Which brings us to the people on the front lines, the intermediaries.
Right, intermediaries. That term sounds a bit formal. Who exactly are we talking about here?
Yeah, think of an intermediary as basically anyone who needs a license to be involved in the insurance transaction process.
So agents.
Agents, navigators.
Yeah.
The folks helping with the health insurance marketplace, brokers, producers. Essentially anyone who is soliciting insurance, negotiating it, giving advice on coverage.
Selling policies, recommending things.
Exactly. Or advising people on their insurance needs. It covers a lot of ground.
Gotcha. So if you're involved in the sale or giving advice for money, you probably need a license. Are there exceptions? People on the edges who aren't intermediaries.
Yes, there are specific carve-outs, like a regular salaried employee of an insurer or a licensed intermediary.
Mm-hmm.
If their main job isn't sales and they don't get commissions, they're usually not considered an intermediary. Same for salaried folks, mainly doing underwriting or claims adjusting for their employer.
Okay.
Also, someone giving incidental advice as part of another job, like maybe an accountant or lawyer.
Right.
If they don't get paid specifically for the insurance part of it, they're generally not an intermediary either.
And those selling travel insurance or warranties?
Yeah, there are limited exceptions for people selling things like travel insurance, portable electronics insurance, or warranties and service contracts under very specific rules.
Clears that up. So within this intermediary group, you mentioned agents and brokers. What's the key difference for the listener?
That's really fundamental. An insurance agent legally represents the insurance company.
Okay. Works for the insurer.
Right. A broker, on the other hand, legally acts on behalf of the insurance applicant or the insured person.
Represents the client.
Exactly. The broker's main duty, legally and ethically, is to the person looking for insurance, not the insurance company itself, even though they might handle things like collecting premiums for the insurer.
Okay. Agent for insurer, broker for client. Makes sense. What about surplus lines? We heard that term before.
Right. A surplus lines agent or broker needs a special license. It lets them place insurance with companies that aren't licensed in Wisconsin, those unauthorized insurers.
Why would you do that?
Usually for risks that are really hard to insure through the normal channels. Think unusual risks, really high risk situations, mm-hmm. Stuff standard insurers might not want to touch.
Got it. For the tough to place stuff. And can a whole business, like a company or partnership, get licensed?
Oh, absolutely. Corporations and partnerships can be licensed as intermediaries in Wisconsin.
As long as
their main people, the partners, officers, directors, meet those strict standards for competence and trustworthiness we'll get into.
Okay. And you also mentioned reinsurance intermediaries and managing general agents. Those sound pretty specialized.
They really are. A reinsurance intermediary broker helps insurance companies pass off some of their own risk to other insurers. That's called ceded reinsurance.
Okay.
A reinsurance intermediary manager actually manages reinsurance business for an insurer.
Right.
And then managing general agents, MGAs, they handle a big chunk of an insurer's business, often production, underwriting, maybe even claims.
So they have a lot of authority.
They do, and there are specific contracts and rules governing that relationship because they have so much control.
And life settlement brokers and providers, that's all about life insurance policies, right?
Correct. Life settlement brokers negotiate deals between people who own life insurance policies and want to sell them, and the life settlement providers, who are the companies that actually buy those policies.
Okay.
Both the brokers and providers need specific licenses for that, too. It's a distinct area.
So lots of different roles, lots of licenses. But what if, say, someone sells a policy but turns out they weren't properly licensed? Is the policy just void?
You know, interestingly, no. Wisconsin law specifically says an insurance contract is still valid, even if it was sold by someone without the right license.
Really?
Yeah. Now, the unlicensed person could still face penalties for operating without a license, obviously.
Right.
But this rule protects the consumer who bought the policy in good faith.
That's a really important protection. Okay, let's get into what it actually takes to become a licensed intermediary. What are the main hoops to jump through?
Well, the big principle is demonstrating competence and trustworthiness.
Competence and trustworthiness. Okay.
That involves paying the fees, obviously.
Yeah.
And meeting a bunch of statutory requirements. Things like showing you genuinely intend to do business, honestly, that you understand the types of insurance you want to sell, that you can analyze a client's needs properly.
Makes sense.
And committing to avoid misrepresentation, managing your finances responsibly, and following all the insurance laws and rules.
Competent and trustworthy. That sounds a bit subjective. How does the commissioner actually figure that out? What do they look at?
They look at a lot, actually. Your criminal record is a big one. Any past convictions.
Okay.
Any previous actions taken against you by insurance regulators anywhere.
Ah.
How accurate your application is. Whether you violated any orders from a commissioner. Any history of misrepresentation or fraud.
Financial stuff, too.
Yep. Financial responsibility is key.
Yeah.
Any delinquent taxes, unpaid child support, and just generally, any history of dishonest business practices or showing you're incompetent or financially irresponsible.
Sounds like a thorough background check.
It is. They vet people pretty carefully.
What about insuring your own stuff? Can an agent get paid commissions for selling themselves a policy?
There are rules around that. Generally, no, you can't get commissions for insuring your own property or life.
Unless,
in the last 12 months, you've also sold other insurance for that same company, and the premiums on that business were more than the premiums on your personal policies.
Ah, so you have to be doing real business, not just using it for a personal discount.
Exactly. It prevents people from just getting a license to save money on their own insurance.
Makes sense. Okay, the exams, it's not just filling out a form, right? You have to pass tests.
Definitely not just a form. The commissioner sets up different classifications for intermediaries and can have different standards, exams, and pre-licensing education for each line of insurance.
So specific tests for life insurance versus property insurance.
Right. Individuals usually have to pass written exams on the Wisconsin laws and regulations for the specific lines they want to sell.
And you need education beforehand.
Usually, yes. Pre-licensing education is typically required to get your first resident license or to add major new lines later on.
Are there exceptions?
Yeah, a few. For certain limited lines like title or credit insurance, and sometimes for people with specific vocational training or college degrees that focus heavily on insurance.
Okay. So you meet the standards, pay fees, get fingerprinted for the background check.
Right.
Complete the education, pass the exam. Then what?
Then you get issued your individual intermediary license for the lines you qualified for.
And an agent can act as both an agent and a broker.
In Wisconsin, yes. A licensed agent has the authority to act in either capacity.
How does the application itself work? Is it all paper?
Mostly online now, actually. For a permanent resident agent license or adding lines, you usually apply online through the OCI's website.
What do they need?
Your personal info, name, address. Electronic proof you did the pre-licensing and passed the background check, pay the fees electronically, and often upload a recent photo.
What if your license lapses? Like you missed the renewal fee by accident. Do you have to start all over again with education and exams?
Not always. Not right away. If it was just revoked for not paying the fee or missing your continuing education deadline or maybe delinquent taxes, you usually have 12 months from the revocation date to get reinstated.
Without redoing everything.
Right. As long as you fix the problem, pay the fees, finish the CE, pay the taxes, then you can usually get it back without the pre-licensing or exams.
But if it's been longer than a year?
Then, yeah, you're generally back to square one. You'll have to meet all the initial requirements again, including education and exams.
Seems fair. Gives you a chance to fix simple mistakes. Now, life changes, people move, businesses change. Do intermediaries have to tell the commissioner about these things?
Absolutely. They have a legal duty to report certain changes within 30 days.
Like what kind of changes?
Name change, address change mailing, residence, or business. If you move out of state, if your partnership dissolves or gets new partners.
Legal stuff, too.
Yep. The date of your first pretrial hearing for any felony or misdemeanor charge except minor traffic stuff, any criminal conviction, again, unless it's really minor, any administrative action taken against you by any licensing agency in any state. And even if you get sued for professional misconduct related to your insurance business, like fraud or misrepresentation.
Wow, that's quite a list. They really want to keep tabs.
They do. They need accurate, up-to-date records.
Okay. What about these temporary licenses? Why would they issue one of those?
Temporary licenses are for very specific, limited situations, and usually for no more than a year.
Such as?
Like if a licensed intermediary dies or becomes legally incapacitated. A temporary license can be given to their personal representative.
Ah, to sell the business.
Exactly. To allow time for an orderly sale or transfer of the business goodwill. Or maybe to help an intermediary recover if they become disabled.
Okay.
Or to allow time to train new people to take over a business. Or if an intermediary gets called up for active military duty.
So mainly for business continuity in tough times. What's the legal status of someone with a temporary license? Are they a fully qualified intermediary?
For most practical purposes, yes. They can generally conduct insurance business.
But there are differences.
Yeah. Key differences are how they got licensed. They didn't do the full process. The license is temporary, obviously. Yeah,
right.
And the commissioner can put specific limits or conditions on what they can do.
Limits. So they might not have full authority.
Correct. The commissioner can restrict their authority however they feel is needed to protect the public and insureds. And they can revoke a temporary license anytime if there's a risk.
Okay.
Plus, the license automatically ends once the business is sold or disposed of by the representative.
Got it. A temporary measure with safeguards. Now, the term navigator came up earlier. How do they fit in? Are they intermediaries?
Navigators are a bit different. They're individuals or groups authorized to help people with the health insurance exchange, like healthcare.gov.
Helping people sign up.
Yeah, helping them understand options on the exchange, assisting with applications, providing unbiased info. They get federal or state funding for this.
Can a regular insurance agent be a navigator?
Sure. A licensed intermediary can apply to be a navigator, but the role itself is legally distinct from being a traditional agent who sells policies for an insurer.
Okay. And what does it take to become a licensed navigator in Wisconsin?
Specific requirements. You need to be 18, a Wisconsin resident with your main business here. Complete the exchange's training program. Pass a state exam, go through a background check with fingerprinting, identify who you're affiliated with, and pay the navigator license fee.
So a separate process tailored to that exchange role. Okay, keeping track of all this.
Yeah.
What about record keeping for regular intermediaries? What do they need to keep? And for how long?
They have pretty significant record-keeping duties. Need to keep detailed records for at least 3 years.
3 years? What kind of records?
All financial stuff, receipts, disbursements, commission statements from insurers, complete records for every policyholder they've worked with.
Like applications, claims info.
Exactly. Original applications, policy changes, claims records, any complaints received. Also, records of their business checking accounts used for insurance, and personnel records for any employees involved in insurance.
And these need to be accurate.
Yep. Updated regularly, following standard accounting principles.
Where do they have to keep all this stuff? At home?
Generally, no. The rule is to keep records at the primary business address that's on file with the OCI.
But they can keep them elsewhere?
They can, but only if they formally notify the commissioner in writing of that alternative location.
And they have to report address changes.
Within 30 days, yes. Changes to business or residence address or where the records are stored. Plus, they also have that separate 30-day requirement to report any felony or misdemeanor convictions or any disciplinary actions from other agencies.
Can the insurance company keep the records for the agent?
Yes. An insurer can agree in writing to take over that responsibility for its agents. But the records still have to be readily available if the commissioner asks for them.
Okay. And title agents have extra rules.
Yeah. Title insurance intermediaries have some additional specific record-keeping requirements, particularly around referral fees and things like that.
Lots to keep track of. Now, what if an agent comes to your house to sell insurance? Are there special rules for that? Home solicitation.
Exactly. Home solicitation selling. That's any sale or solicitation that happens away from the agent's regular business place, like at your home or work.
Okay. What do they have to tell you?
Right at the very start, the first contact, they have to clearly state their full name, the name of their firm or agency, that they are, in fact, selling or soliciting insurance, the name of the specific insurer, if they represent one primarily, and what type of insurance they're offering.
So no ambiguity about who they are and why they're there.
Right. And if they take any money from you during that visit, they have to give you a detailed receipt. It needs the date, what policy you applied for, how much you paid, and contact info for both the agent and the insurance company.
And things they can't do.
Yeah. Prohibited practices include misrepresenting special offers, using surveys or contests as a trick to start a sales pitch, or any other deceptive tactics.
Seems designed to make sure the consumer isn't misled right off the bat.
What about personal financial dealings between agents and customers? Any restrictions there?
Yeah.
Conflict of interest?
Yes, definitely. Wisconsin law generally stops agents from doing certain personal financial transactions with people they've done insurance business with in the last 3 years.
What kind of transactions? It's pretty broad. Borrowing money or property from a client, lending to them, acting as a custodian, or having power of attorney over their assets.
Mm-hmm.
Getting personal guarantees from them, sharing in their business profits or losses, or buying property from them without paying fair value.
But what about normal insurance stuff, like collecting premiums?
Right. There are exceptions for things done in the normal course of insurance business, holding a policy for service, properly recording premium payments, that kind of thing is fine.
So it's really about stopping agents from using that relationship for personal gain outside of insurance. What if an agent does cross these lines or does other shady things? What counts as an unfair trade practice for an agent?
Several things are explicitly called out. Doing those prohibited personal financial transactions we just talked about.
Okay.
Being named a beneficiary on a client's life insurance or annuity if the agent doesn't have a legitimate insurable interest.
Right.
Violating securities or franchise laws.
Mm-hmm.
Lying about their own qualifications or credentials. And knowingly selling health coverage while falsely claiming it's exempt from state rules under ERISA when it's really not.
Seems like a focus on honesty and ethical conduct. Now, we talked about getting licensed. How does an agent get authorized to sell for a specific company?
The insurance company itself have to formally appoint that intermediary with the OCI.
Appoint them.
Yeah. They have to do this either before or within 15 days after the agent's contract is signed, or within 15 days after the agent submits their first application to that company, whichever happens first.
How do they do that?
The company electronically submits the appointment info into the OCI system, providing all the required details about the agent.
Are there exceptions?
There's a slight wrinkle for companies selling long-term care insurance or annuities. They have some extra requirements around agent appointments for those products.
Okay. So the company officially tells the state, this person represents us. Now, keeping that license active costs money, right? Ongoing fees.
Yes. There's a biennial regulation charge that means every 2 years. Currently, it's $35 for resident intermediaries and $70 for non-residents.
And they remind you?
Usually. The OCI typically sends a renewal notice to the intermediary's business email address on file about 60 days before expiration.
What if you don't pay?
If the fee isn't paid by the due date, the license is automatically revoked.
Okay, pay to play. How long does the license actually last? Is it just forever if you keep paying?
Not quite. It stays in effect until something happens.
Right.
Like it gets revoked, suspended, or limited by the commissioner after a hearing. Or the intermediary voluntarily gives it up,
mm-hmm.
or the intermediary dies, or is found mentally incompetent by a court, or if the commissioner finds after a hearing that they just don't meet the qualifications anymore.
So it's not just about fees. You have to stay qualified and ethical. What are some reasons the commissioner might revoke, suspend, or limit a license after a hearing?
Several grounds. Repeatedly or knowingly breaking insurance laws, rules, or orders. Using business methods that endanger customers or the public. Not having adequate financial resources to conduct business properly.
Lying on the application.
Yep. Providing false info on the application or renewals.
Mm-hmm.
Or just generally being found unqualified, incompetent, or untrustworthy.
We talked about getting reinstated after administrative stuff, like not paying fees. What if the license was revoked for these more serious reasons? Can you reapply then?
It's different. If it was just fees or CE, you can usually get reinstated quickly once you fix it.
Right.
But if it was revoked for conduct, competence, or trustworthiness issues, the commissioner can set a waiting period up to 5 years before you can even apply again.
5 years.
Up to 5 years. If the order doesn't specify a waiting period, then a standard 5-year wait automatically applies from the revocation date before you can submit a new application.
So, serious consequences for serious violations. Can you give a few more specific examples of things that could get an intermediary discipline?
Sure. Things like consistently using unlicensed people to give insurance advice, willfully disobeying a lawful order from the commissioner, not paying required fees, actively promoting unfair or deceptive marketing practices as a sales technique.
What about recommending bad policies?
Exactly. Recommending insurance products to people without a reasonable basis to believe those products are actually suitable for their needs and circumstances.
Makes sense. Now, what happens during that time when someone's license is revoked or surrendered? Are there restrictions on what they or people associated with them can do in the insurance world?
Yes, there's a formal disciplinary period. It starts when the license terminates and ends if and when a new license is issued.
And during that time,
the commissioner can discipline not just the intermediary, but anyone who knowingly uses their services in connection with insurance.
Uses their services? Who counts as a disciplined person?
It's defined broadly. It includes the individual whose license was revoked or surrendered, any affiliated businesses, certain states, even employees of the disciplined person.
So the impact spreads. What can't they do?
The disciplined intermediary is barred from being employed by acting as an intermediary for or being affiliated in any way with anyone engaged in the insurance intermediary business in Wisconsin during that period.
And other intermediaries can't work with them.
Right. No one in the intermediary business can use or even refer to an endorsement or referral from a disciplined intermediary to try and get business during that person's disciplinary period.
A clean break is required, essentially.
That's the idea. To protect the public.
Okay. Let's shift to how insurance is marketed and sold. We keep seeing the term unfair marketing practices. What kinds of things fall under that umbrella?
It's a broad category covering actions that are deceptive, misleading, unfairly discriminatory, or that unreasonably restrain competition.
Like what specifically?
Misrepresentation of policies or benefits. Using unfair inducements like rebating premium.
Rebating.
Yeah. Offering benefits not specified in the policy to get someone to buy or drop coverage. Also, unfair discrimination in rates or coverage. Actions that restrain competition, like boycotts or intimidation.
Anything else?
Unfairly restricting someone's choice of insurer. Imposing extra, unjustified charges. Trying to influence employers about hiring or firing related to insurance. Using an official government position unfairly. And unreasonably refusing to return company materials when an agency contract ends.
Misrepresentation sounds like a big one. What counts as misrepresentation?
It's making any communication written or oral about an insurance contract, the insurance business, an insurer's financial status, or an intermediary's qualifications that contains false info or is misleading.
Even by leaving things out?
Absolutely. Omitting key facts that make the whole statement misleading counts. So does deceptive record keeping. Or using misleading names or logos.
And if an agent misrepresents something while referencing the company they work for?
There's actually a legal presumption that the insurance company itself has also committed the violation in that case.
Wow, so the company can be on the hook. What about unfair inducement or rebating, offering kickbacks?
Basically, yeah. No insurer, employee, rep, or intermediary can influence someone's decision about buying, keeping, or dropping a policy by offering or promising any benefit or advantage that isn't actually spelled out of the policy contract itself.
Are there any exceptions?
Well, reducing premiums because of legitimate cost savings from a real mass marketing plan usually doesn't count as prohibited rebating.
Okay. And agents can't pay the premium tax for the customer on unauthorized insurance.
Correct. Intermediaries, brokers, and insurers are all prohibited from absorbing or paying that premium tax on unauthorized coverage when the policyholder is legally responsible for it.
Got it. No secret side deals. What about unfair discrimination? How does that play out?
It means insurers can't charge different rates for the same coverage or offer different terms unless the difference is based on reasonable classifications that genuinely reflect differences in the risk or the insurer's expenses.
So differences have to be justified by risk or cost.
Right. A rate isn't automatically unfair just because two similar risks have different expense factors or vice versa, as long as the overall rate reasonably reflects that combination. And averaging rates in group policies is generally okay.
Okay. And restraint of competition. What does that look like in insurance?
It's about illegal acts like boycotts, coercion, or intimidation that tend to unreasonably restrict the insurance business or create a monopoly.
And this applies to everyone.
Pretty much. Companies, intermediaries, their employees, agents, even others trying to compete in the market.
Trying to keep the playing field level. We also saw a rule about not restricting someone's choice of insurer.
Yeah. If a contract requires someone to buy insurance, the party requiring the insurance can't tell the other party which specific insurance company they must use.
But can they reject the insurer chosen?
Yes, they can disapprove the chosen insurer, but only on reasonable business grounds. They can't reject them just because of the insurer's corporate structure or affiliations.
So no forcing you into their preferred company. What are these prohibited extra charges?
Basically, you can't charge fees beyond the premium and legitimate premium financing costs when insurance is required for financing property or as loan collateral. Keeps extra costs from being tacked on.
Makes sense. And government officials can't use their position to push insurance sales?
Definitely not. Anyone in state government, elected, appointed, civil service is prohibited from using their official power or influence to coerce or pressure anyone into buying insurance from a specific intermediary or company.
No abusing public office for private gain. What about employers influencing employees' insurance choices or job status?
Also prohibited. Insurers, intermediaries, their employees, or agents can't try to unduly influence an employer's hiring or firing decisions in connection with an insurance transaction.
Right.
Your job shouldn't depend on your insurance choices.
Right. And the rule about returning agency materials, logos, letterhead?
Pretty straightforward. If the insurance company demands it, the agent has to promptly return materials that indicate their former agency relationship.
Okay. Hand back the branding when you leave.
Yeah.
And the commissioner can define more unfair practices later on.
Yes. They have the power to make administrative rules defining other practices as unfair if they're found to be misleading, deceptive, discriminatory, an unfair inducement, or if they unreasonably restrain competition. Let the rules adapt.
And we've seen examples of that, right?
Right.
Rules about replacing life insurance, prohibiting certain risk classifications.
Exactly. There are detailed rules on disclosures needed when replacing life insurance or annuities. Rules against discrimination based on sex, disability, sexual orientation, location, age, and lots of specific examples of misrepresentation spelled out, like lying about Medicare supplement benefits, bad-mouthing competitors falsely, pretending to be from Social Security, using fake company affiliations on business cards, falsely claiming state endorsement, lying about company takeovers to sell new policies, or guaranteeing disability income without explaining the limitations.
Clearly, a strong focus on truthfulness and fair dealing. Now, if an agent is appointed by an insurer and they mess up or do something wrong within their authority, is the company responsible?
Yes, generally. Under Wisconsin law, the insurance company is legally bound by the actions of its appointed agent, as long as those actions are within the agent's authorized scope of business in Wisconsin.
And this lasts.
As long as the agency contract is in effect, or until the company makes reasonable efforts to get back its policy forms, rate books, and other agency materials from the terminated agent.
What counts as reasonable efforts?
Usually involves sending a formal written demand for the return of company property and notifying the OCI if the agent doesn't comply.
So companies need to be careful who they appoint and oversee them. Let's talk compensation. We know agents can't profit excessively from their own risks. What are the general rules? Can they charge fees directly to clients?
They can. A licensed agent or broker can charge a client a fee for buying insurance or for advice. But there's a big transparency requirement. Before the client is obligated to pay the fee, the agent broker must clearly disclose in writing the exact amount they'll get from the insured.
Okay.
And clearly state whether they'll also get compensation from any other source, like a commission from the insurance company.
Full disclosure. Got it. What about sharing commissions? Like if one agent refers a client to another.
Generally, you can't share commissions with someone who isn't licensed in Wisconsin for services performed here.
But licensed people can share.
Yes. A licensed intermediary can direct their commissions to their own partnership or corporation. Companies can pay deferred commissions to former licensees. And there's something called proper exchange of business between licensed intermediaries.
Proper exchange of business. What does that mean?
It's usually when one agent forwards business to another because they can't place it themselves. Maybe the insurer won't take the risk or imposes tough conditions.
Okay.
In that case, the The forwarding agent can share in the commission with the agent who actually places the business.
But not just for a name. No simple referral fees.
Generally not, unless the referrer is also licensed. For a proper exchange, both agents need to be licensed in the same line of insurance involved.
Uh-huh.
And both need to either sign the application or have their names on the policy.
Are there limits?
Yeah, there are volume limits. Exchanging more than 5 risks a year with one non-listed insurer or more than 25 exchanges total per year creates a presumption you're going beyond a proper exchange.
So it's for real collaboration, not just funneling business. Lastly, what about agents using senior-specific designations, like certified senior advisor?
There are rules about that, too. The concern is misleading seniors about an intermediary's actual qualifications or expertise.
So they can't just use any title.
Right. You can't use a designation that falsely implies certification or expertise you don't have. That includes using fake or self-given titles, exaggerating skills, or getting a designation from an organization that has flimsy standards or is mainly just a sales and marketing outfit.
Okay, protecting seniors from misleading credentials. Makes sense.
Now that we've covered intermediaries thoroughly, let's shift over to the insurance contracts themselves. Chapter 631 and 632 in the Wisconsin statutes are really key here. They lay out the basic legal rules and minimum standards for policies delivered or issued in Wisconsin.
So these chapters are kind of the foundation for insurance contracts here.
Exactly. They aim to provide a baseline level of consumer protection and set clear ground rules for that relationship between the insurer and the insured, but still allow flexibility in the actual policy details.
Do these rules in Chapter 631 and 632 apply to absolutely every insurance policy sold in Wisconsin?
Pretty much, generally speaking. They cover policies delivered or issued here if they insure Wisconsin residents, property normally located here, or business operations happening in the state.
But I bet there are exceptions, some types of coverage that aren't included.
You bet right. There are several specific carve-outs. For instance, some death and disability benefits from organizations that aren't primarily insurance companies. Maybe certain charities might be exempt if there's no strict legal obligation to pay a set amount.
Okay. What else?
Certain group or blanket policies where the group wasn't formed just to get insurance and only a few Wisconsin residents are covered. Insurance bought directly from unauthorized insurers.
Uh-huh.
Most reinsurance where insurers insure each other, and most ocean marine insurance are typically out.
Right.
And group policies or annuities issued to nonprofit, charitable, religious, or educational institutions are also generally exempt.
And the commissioner can make other exceptions.
Yes. They have the authority to exempt other classes of insurance or companies if they decide. Policyholder and public interest don't really require that level of regulation.
Okay, so some specific exceptions. What about binders? Or even just an oral agreement for insurance. Are those legally binding?
Yes, they are. Wisconsin law recognizes both oral insurance contracts and written promises like binders as valid, assuming there's clear agreement on the key terms.
And then the company has to issue a formal policy.
Exactly. The insurer then has a legal duty to issue the actual policy document as soon as reasonably possible after that oral agreement or binder.
Good to know. Now, insurable interest. We heard that before with life insurance. Why is that concept so critical?
It's absolutely fundamental. An insurer can't knowingly issue a policy to someone who doesn't have a valid insurable interest in whatever is being insured.
And insurable interest means?
Basically, you have to stand to suffer a direct financial loss or some other real harm if the insured event actually happens. Like, you have an insurable interest in your own house because you'd lose money if it burned down.
But probably not in my neighbor's house.
Exactly. You need to have some skin in the game, so to speak.
What about insuring someone else's life or health? Can I just take out a policy on anyone?
Generally, no. For individual life and disability policies, the insurer usually needs the written consent of the person being insured before issuing the policy to someone else as the owner or beneficiary.
And signing the application usually counts as consent.
Typically, yes. The insured signature on the application is generally enough.
Are there situations where you can get life or disability insurance on someone without their written consent?
Yes. A few specific exceptions exist. You can usually insure a minor child who can't legally consent themselves.
Okay.
A creditor can often insure a debtor, but usually only up to the amount related to the debt.
Makes sense.
You can generally insure close family members living with you or who are dependent. And disability policies can cover expenses you're legally obligated to pay for someone else.
Any others?
There's a narrow one for limited-term life policies on federal personnel serving overseas, where the policyholder is closely related.
What if the person can't consent, maybe due to incapacity? Can someone else consent for them?
In certain cases, yes. A parent or legal guardian can usually consent for a dependent child. A grandparent might be able to for a grandchild. And a court can issue an order granting consent if needed.
So safeguards are in place. What happens if a policy is issued without the required insurable interest or consent?
It could potentially be declared legally void from the start, meaning it's not a valid, enforceable contract under Wisconsin law.
A pretty major defect. Okay, let's talk about what the agent knows. If an agent learns something important about the risk, does the insurance company automatically know it too?
Generally, yes. It's called imputed knowledge. The company is usually held to know any material fact or policy violation that their authorized agent knew when they bound coverage, issued the policy, or took the application.
Does that apply later too? If the agent learns something after the policy is issued?
Yes, if the agent learns about it later while actively dealing with that policyholder in their official role, and they know it relates to that specific policy, the company is generally considered to know too.
So the agent's knowledge is often the company's knowledge. What if the policyholder fails to do something required by the policy, like notify within a certain time, but it's because of something the agent said or did?
In most cases, that failure by the policyholder won't hurt their coverage or the insurer's obligations.
Even if the agent was maybe acting a bit outside their strict authority?
Potentially, yes. The law recognizes policyholders shouldn't be penalized for reasonably relying on the insurer's representatives.
Seems fair. Is telling the agent something official, like reporting a claim, the same as telling the company directly?
Yes. If the policyholder notifies an authorized agent and gives enough info to identify the policy, that's legally considered proper notice to the insurance company itself.
So the agent is the official contact point. But what if the agent and the policyholder team up to cheat the company? Collusion.
Well, those principles about the company being responsible for the agent's knowledge and actions don't apply if there's clear evidence of collusion to deceive or defraud the insurer.
Okay.
Or if the policyholder knew the agent was acting beyond their authority. The law protects insurers from deliberate fraud involving both parties.
A necessary protection. Now, application statements. What's the legal difference between a representation and a warranty?
A representation is just a statement, oral or written, made by the applicant during the application process.
Mm-hmm.
The insurer relies on these. A warranty is more serious. It's a statement or promise actually written into the contract itself. Historically, the policy's validity often depended on the absolute, literal truth of a warranty.
Are warranties common now?
Less so. Representations are more typical today.
And what's the difference between just a misrepresentation and a material misrepresentation?
A simple misrepresentation is just an untrue statement. A material one is significant enough that it would likely influence a reasonable insurer's decision about whether to take the risk or what premium to charge.
What happens if someone misrepresents something or breaches a warranty? Can the insurer just cancel the policy?
Not automatically, especially if it's someone other than the insurer or agent making the statement. Generally, it won't let the insurer rescind the policy or avoid obligations unless...
Unless what?
Unless the person knew the statement was false and the insurer relied on it and was material or are made with intent to deceive, or if the misrepresented fact actually contributed to the loss.
So it usually has to be a knowing, important falsehood or directly related to the loss. What if the insurer already knew the truth when they issued the policy? Can they use a misrepresentation about that fact later?
No. Wisconsin law generally stops them from using a misrepresentation or breach of warranty if the insurer had constructive knowledge, what the agent knew usually, or actual knowledge of the true facts when the policy was issued.
But there was an exception about handwritten applications.
Right. If the application is entirely in the applicant's handwriting, the agent's knowledge isn't automatically considered constructive knowledge for the company in this specific context.
Interesting detail. What if the insurer finds out about a reason to cancel or deny a claim after the policy is already in force? Is there a deadline for them to act?
Yes. If they get info after issuing the policy that gives them grounds to rescind it or defend against a claim, they have a duty to notify the insured of their intent.
How long do they have?
Generally 60 days from when they acquired that knowledge. It's 120 days if they reasonably need more medical info.
And if they miss that deadline?
They might be legally barred from rescinding the policy or using that defense later on.
So they have to act relatively quickly. Now, policy documents often refer to the application or other papers. Can a contract just say, see document X for terms, incorporation by reference?
No, Wisconsin law generally prohibits that. The insurance contract can't include agreements or provisions unless they are fully set out in the policy, the application, or attached documents when it's delivered.
Everything should be right there.
That's the idea. Transparency. There are very limited exceptions for things like complex rate schedules that are impractical to put in the main policy.
Clarity is key. What about privacy? Protecting medical records, financial info collected during the insurance process.
Wisconsin law has significant protections, aligning with federal laws like IPAI and GLB. Chapter 25 of the Administrative Code specifically deals with agents' responsibilities when sharing private financial or health info with third parties.
What does it require?
It requires written privacy policy notices to consumers. Usually, agents can rely on the insurers they represent to provide these notices.
But sometimes the agent has to provide their own.
Yes. If the agent does more than just market for the insurer or shares client info directly with non-affiliated third parties outside the normal transaction, they might have their own duty to get authorization and provide notices.
And medical records have separate protection.
Yes. There's a distinct state statute, Section 610.70, that covers medical record privacy in detail, though we won't dive deep into that today.
Okay. What about the actual policy forms insurers use? Can they just create and use whatever they want?
No, generally not. They usually have to file the form with the OCI before using it. Wisconsin uses a file and use system for many forms.
File and use?
Means they can start using the form 30 days after filing it if they also submit a certification that it complies with all the laws and rules.
But not for all forms. Some need prior approval.
Correct. Things like healthcare liability, workers' comp, Medicare supplement, long-term care insurance, service contracts, warranties, those generally require explicit approval from the commissioner before they can be used.
So some get a faster track, others need a closer look. What if a form that's already in use is later found to be non-compliant?
The commissioner can take action. After a hearing, if they find a form would be disapproved if filed new, they can order the insurer to stop using it or make changes to bring it into compliance.
Ongoing oversight. Now, that Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Compact, the IIPRC, what's that about again? Simplifying approvals across states.
Exactly. It's a formal agreement between member states. It set up a commission that acts as a single place to file and get regulatory review for certain types of insurance policy forms.
So insurers don't have to file the same form in every single state.
Right. For eligible products, they can submit to the IIPRC for a coordinated review.
Which products are eligible?
The IIPRC has uniform national standards for life insurance, annuities, disability income, and long-term care insurance, including their advertising materials.
And Wisconsin is part of this compact.
Yes. Wisconsin joined back in March 2008. So if an insurer gets IIPRC approval for a form and has authority to operate here for that line, they can generally use that form in Wisconsin.
Sounds efficient. But are those national standards always identical to Wisconsin's specific rules?
Not always. While they were developed collaboratively and aim for high standards, there might be specific differences compared to Wisconsin's unique laws. By joining, Wisconsin agreed to follow the compact standards for forms approved through that system. Insurers need to be aware of potential differences. Okay, let's dig into some specific clauses you often find in insurance contracts. A really important one is about when an insurer can legally cancel a policy midterm, you know, before its normal expiration date.
Right, you've got a policy and suddenly they want to end it early. When is that allowed in Wisconsin?
For most policies, with exceptions like brand new ones, less than 60 days old, umbrella excess liability, and some aviation war risk coverage, an insurer can only cancel midterm for a few specific reasons.
Like what?
Failure to pay the premium is a big one.
Makes sense.
Material misrepresentation by the policyholder during the application. A substantial change in the risk that the insurer couldn't have reasonably foreseen.
Okay.
A substantial breach of the contract by the policyholder. Or, for some life annuity policies, hitting a specific terminal age defined in the policy. Though usually they have to return unearned premium then.
Seems like pretty major reasons. What kind of notice do they have to give?
Usually written notice at least 10 days before the cancellation takes effect.
Yeah.
Sent by first-class mail or delivered personally.
10 days. Are there exceptions?
For those aviation war risk policies, it's only 7 days. But for workers' compensation, it's tougher.
How so?
At least 30 days written notice. And it has to go not just to the policyholder, but also to the Wisconsin Compensation Rating Bureau, the WCRB.
30 days for workers' comp. Got it.
Although, even without direct notice to the policyholder, a workers' comp cancellation can still be effective if the employer gets replacement coverage elsewhere or gets an exemption order from the state.
Okay. What about brand new policies? Less than 60 days old. Are the cancellation rules different then?
Yes, slightly.
Yeah.
The grounds for cancellation and notice rules are a bit different. They still generally need to give 10 days written notice, but they don't always have to state the specific reason in the notice unless it's a health insurance policy.
Interesting. But the 30-day rule for workers' comp still applies, even if it's new.
Yes. The 30-day notice to both the policyholder and the WCRB applies for canceling new workers' comp policies midterm.
So a bit more leeway for insurers in that initial period. Now, what about renewal? When a policy is ending, does the insurer have to offer to renew it?
Generally, yes. The policyholder usually has a right to renew for another term same length if the last one was a year or less, or for 1 year if it was longer.
On what terms?
On the insurer's current terms and rates for similar risks. Unless.
Unless?
Unless the insurer sends a formal notice of non-renewal at least 60 days before the policy expires.
And that notice has to say why?
Yes, it must be in writing and clearly state the factual reasons for the non-renewal decision.
What if the reason is just that the policyholder didn't pay the renewal premium? Specific notice, then.
Yes. To terminate for non-payment of renewal premium, the insurer has to send a written notice between 10 and 75 days before the premium due date.
Okay.
And that notice has to clearly spell out what happens if the premium isn't paid. For workers' comp, that window is 30 to 75 days before the due date.
Are there times when these renewal rules don't apply?
Yes. If the policyholder already got coverage elsewhere, if they asked for or agreed to the non-renewal, or if the policy was explicitly non-renewable from the start, and for workers' comp non-renewal, the insurer also has to give the WCRB 60 days notice.
So rules protect against surprise non-renewals. What if the insurer offers renewal, but the terms are way worse or the rate is much higher?
Okay, if they offer renewal outside of personal lines, property casualty, on less favorable terms or higher rates, those changes only take effect on the renewal date if they gave you notice at least 60 days prior.
And if they give notice within that 60-day window,
then the new terms rates don't kick in until 60 days after you receive the notice. Gives you time to review and cancel if you want.
What if they give no notice before renewal?
Then the policy renews on the old terms and rates, with premium adjusted proportionally.
But this doesn't apply to small rate hikes.
Right. Doesn't typically apply to general rate increases under 25% affecting a whole class, or premium changes just due to reclassifying the risk.
So they can't ambush you with a bad deal. There was also a rule about not canceling or non-renewing just because of accidents during business or employment?
Yes. An insurer generally can't issue a less favorable policy or cancel non-renew solely because of an accident that happened in the course of the insured's business or employment, unless the policy was actually designed to cover that specific liability.
So you shouldn't be penalized for using the insurance for what it's meant for.
Exactly. That's the intent.
What if an insurer drops an agent? Can they then non-renew all the policies that agent sold?
No. They can only non-renew based on the specific legal reasons we discussed. If they terminate an agent, they generally still have to offer renewal to the policyholder sold by that agent, if the policyholder requests it.
Unless the policyholder no longer qualifies.
Right, unless they no longer meet the insurer's normal underwriting criteria. And again, specific rules apply for workers' comp in this situation.
So your coverage isn't tied just to the agent staying with the company. When insurers send those cancellation or non-renewal notices, what info must be included?
They have to state, with reasonable precision, the factual basis for the decision. The why.
Okay. And anything else?
Yes. If there's a state risk-sharing plan for that type of insurance.
Like WAIP or WIP?
Exactly. The notice must include clear instructions on how the policyholder can apply for coverage under that plan.
But not if it's just for non-payment.
Right. That requirement doesn't apply if the only reason is non-payment or if it's a mandatory healthcare liability risk-sharing plan.
So a clear reason and potentially directions for next steps. Is the insurer protected if they state the required reasons? Honestly, can they get sued for it?
Generally, no. Wisconsin law shields insurers, their reps, agents, employees, etc., from civil liability for providing that information as long as they're acting in good faith to comply with the notice requirements.
So they're protected when following the rules. We saw an example of a non-renewal notice that wasn't effective. What was wrong with it?
That example was a homeowner's policy notice. It just said the policy wouldn't be renewed but gave no factual reason why. And crucially, it also failed to mention how the policyholder could apply to the Wisconsin insurance plan WIP, the property risk sharing plan.
So it missed two key required pieces of info.
Exactly. Lacked the reason and the risk sharing plan info, making it legally ineffective.
Complete info is critical. Now, what if someone has two or more policies covering the same loss? How does that work? Can you collect from both fully?
No, you can't profit from a loss. The total you can recover from all policies combined is limited to the lesser of your actual financial loss, or the total amount of coverage promised by all policies together.
Even if the policies have other insurance clauses.
Yes. The policy definitions of primary versus excess coverage usually control, but if those clauses conflict,
then what?
Then all the insurers involved are typically held jointly and severally liable up to their policy limits. How they sort it out amongst themselves later doesn't affect the insured's right to recover their loss.
Okay. But this doesn't stop an insurer from fighting a fraudulent claim.
Correct. They still have the right to defend against fraudulent misrepresentation.
What about those non-waiver clauses in policies? The ones saying only executives can change things and agents can't waive provisions. Are those always strictly enforced?
Insurers can include those clauses. Mm-hmm. They typically state changes need exec approval and an endorsement, and that agents lack authority to change or waive things. But Wisconsin law says these clauses don't completely prevent the insured from relying on legal ideas like waivers or estoppel.
Meaning,
if the insurer's or agent's actions or statements reasonably led the insured to believe a provision was waived, the company might not be able to enforce it later, even with the non-waiver clause. Courts look at the whole picture and the insured's reasonable expectations.
So the company's conduct can sometimes override the strict policy wording. Finally, what about the policyholder's duties after a loss? Notice and proof of loss.
The insured needs to provide proof of loss as soon as reasonably possible, and generally within 1 year after the policy requires it.
What if they miss the deadline? Is the claim dead?
Not automatically. Failing to meet the policy's time limit won't invalidate or reduce the claim unless the insurer can show they were actually harmed by the delay and it was reasonably possible for the insured to meet the deadline.
Okay. And just mailing it is enough?
Proper mailing or delivery generally counts as sufficient notice and proof.
What if the insurer acknowledges the notice, sends forms, or investigates? Does that waive their rights?
No. Those actions by themselves, acknowledging notice, providing forms, accepting proofs, investigating, don't automatically waive any of the insurer's rights or defenses under the policy. All right, let's shift gears to what happens after a claim is filed, the claim settlement practices. Wisconsin has specific rules here to ensure fair treatment by defining certain practices as unfair.
So it's not just about if they pay, but how they handle the whole process. How quickly do they have to pay a covered claim?
Unless the law says otherwise for a specific type, claims are supposed to be paid promptly. A claim is legally overdue if not paid within 30 days after the insurer gets written notice of the covered loss and the amount claimed.
30 days? What if it's just a partial claim?
Same 30-day clock starts for that partial payment once they get written notice supporting it.
Can the insurer delay if they think they aren't responsible?
Yes, payment isn't overdue if the insurer has reasonable proof they aren't responsible, even if they got notice.
When does the payment date count from mailing?
Yeah, the date the check is mailed or otherwise delivered.
And if it is overdue, interest.
Yep, 7.5% simple interest per year accrues on overdue payments.
But the clock doesn't start until they have proof of loss.
Correct. It's not overdue until 30 days after they receive satisfactory proof of loss or equivalent evidence they reasonably requested. And delay might be justified if they genuinely can't figure out who to pay.
Okay, prompt payment is key. What are some examples of unfair claim settlement practices? Things insurers shouldn't do.
Well, things done without just cause and often enough to look like a general business practice. Like failing to promptly acknowledge communications about claims.
Ignoring emails or letters.
Basically. Or failing to promptly provide necessary claim forms, instructions, and reasonable help to insureds and claimants navigating the process.
So being unresponsive or unhelpful, what about discrimination in claims? Specifically sex discrimination.
Absolutely prohibited. Insurers cannot refuse or cancel coverage, or deny, restrict, modify, or reduce benefits based solely on sex.
Can you give some examples of what that looks like in practice?
Sure. Denying coverage to women working at home or part-time when men in similar situations get it. Denying rider benefits to women when they're available to men.
Treating pregnancy complications differently.
Yes, treating pregnancy complications differently from any other sickness covered by the policy. Restricting benefits for conditions affecting only one sex's genital organs.
Mm-hmm.
offering lower maximums or shorter benefit periods on disability policies for women in the same risk class as men, or setting different conditions based on sex for exercising policy benefit options. Okay, let's venture into a slightly different zone. Surplus lines and unauthorized insurance. It's useful for listeners to know the difference between an unauthorized insurer and unauthorized insurance.
Right, surplus lines. This usually involves insurers not licensed here in Wisconsin.
That's the core of it. Surplus lines insurance is coverage placed with insurers who are not licensed, unauthorized in Wisconsin. It's done by an intermediary holding a special surplus lines license.
Which is an extra license.
Yep, on top of their regular property and casualty license, with an annual fee. Now, an insurer without a Wisconsin certificate of authority can still write policies for Wisconsin residents on risks here, but under very specific rules.
What can these unauthorized insurers actually do in Wisconsin?
They can negotiate contracts, inspect risks here, collect premiums, adjust losses under those policies, and do other incidental things related to contracts lawfully issued outside Wisconsin.
What are their obligations and the surplus lines agent's obligations to the policyholder? Transparency seems key.
Absolutely. Both the unauthorized insurer and the surplus lines intermediary must give the policyholder a formal proposal form before binding coverage.
And that form has to say?
It has to clearly state the insurer isn't licensed in Wisconsin and isn't subject to all state regulations, except for certain rules like unfair claim settlement practices.
What about taxes?
The policyholder usually pays a 3% premium tax. The surplus lines agent collects it and must keep those tax funds in a completely separate bank account, no commingling.
Can regular agents work with surplus lines agents? Share commissions?
Yes, the proper exchange of business rules we discussed allow that. A regular agent can get surplus lines coverage for a client through a surplus lines licensee and share the commission following the rules.
And didn't Wisconsin insurers recently get allowed to write surplus lines too?
Yes, that was 2017 Wisconsin Act 16. It allows certain domestic Wisconsin insurers to also provide surplus lines coverage under specific requirements.
Interesting. What about when a Wisconsin resident buys directly from an unauthorized insurer without a Wisconsin agent involved? Direct placement.
Right. That usually happens when no Wisconsin intermediary is involved and most negotiations happen outside the state.
But sending a letter here counts as negotiating here.
Yes. A letter sent to or from a Wisconsin address legally counts as negotiation within the state.
What does the policyholder have to do in that direct placement scenario?
If they directly get or renew coverage from an unauthorized insurer, excluding surplus lines and renewals of certain guaranteed renewable policies, they must report it to the commissioner within 60 days using a specific form in 6.11.
And pay taxes.
And pay any applicable Wisconsin premium taxes. Wisconsin intermediaries aren't usually too involved, other than knowing residents can buy from anyone if the deal is mostly out of state.
Is there a penalty for messing this up?
Yes. Anyone violating the direct placement rules can be held personally liable for damages to claimants under that policy.
Ouch. Okay. What about risk purchasing groups and risk retention groups? How do they fit in?
A risk purchasing group is a bunch of businesses with similar risks that band together to buy liability insurance as a group.
What's the agent's role there?
The agent placing coverage with one has a duty to check if the group and insurer are financially sound and ethical. They need to notify insureds of known insurer deficiencies and investigate the insurer's finances and reputation.
And risk retention groups, they're a bit different.
Yes, they're formed by businesses with similar liability risks, mainly to insure their own members. Usually licensed in one state, but can operate elsewhere.
What must an agent tell an applicant before taking an application for a policy from an unauthorized risk retention group?
They have to inform the applicant about any known insurer deficiencies, that the group isn't directly regulated by Wisconsin, that the coverage isn't protected by the state's insurance security fund, and anything else the commissioner requires.
So extra disclosures and due diligence for these less traditional setups. Switching gears, slightly consumer rights. Insurers have to tell people they can complain to the state.
Yes. All insurers have to notify policyholders at least once per policy or certificate about their right to file a formal complaint with the OCI if they have issues.
Good to know there's a formal channel. And finally, can insurers send notices and documents electronically?
Yes, electronic delivery is allowed, but it has to comply with Wisconsin's Electronic Transactions and Signatures Law, Chapter 137, Subchapter 2. That usually means getting the consumer's consent and ensuring they can access and keep the info. Okay, let's pivot to a major category. Property and casualty insurance. This is a really broad term in the insurance world.
Property and casualty, or P&C. So basically everything that isn't life or health insurance.
That's the general idea, yeah. Okay. It covers a huge range. Think fire insurance, auto insurance, homeowners, general liability.
Workers' comp, inland marine.
Exactly. Workers' comp falls under P&C, inland marine covering transport risks, legal expense insurance we touched on. Lots of different lines.
A massive part of the market. Let's talk rates for P&C. Do companies have to file their rates with the state?
Generally, yes. Authorized insurers and rate service organizations have to file all their rates, supplementary info, and any changes with the commissioner within 30 days after they become effective.
After. So they don't need prior approval usually.
Correct. With the big exceptions of workers' comp rates and the rates used by WAP and WIP, most P&C rates in Wisconsin don't require prior approval. It's a file-and-use system.
But the commissioner can step in later.
Absolutely. They retain the authority to hold a hearing and disapprove rates if they violate the legal standards.
What are those standards? When can a rate be disapproved?
The main grounds are if a rate is found to be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory.
Excessive, meaning too high.
Yes. It's presumed not excessive if there's reasonable price competition in the market. If not, it's excessive if it's likely to produce unreasonably high profits long term.
And inadequate. Too low.
Right. Clearly insufficient to cover projected losses and expenses, considering investment income.
And unfairly discriminatory.
Fails to equitably reflect genuine differences in expected losses and expenses among policyholders in the same risk class. But differences just due to expense factors versus loss factors aren't automatically discriminatory, as long as the overall rate is reasonable. And averaging rates in group policies is usually okay.
So rates have to be balanced, fair to consumers, enough for insurers, and based on real risk differences. Are any P&C lines exempt from these rate filing rules?
Yes, a few. Unique inland marine risks, individually rated risks, or consent to rate situations, certain title insurance rates. And as we said, workers' comp is totally separate with its own rate law.
Okay. Now, how about classifying risks for rating? Are there things insurers cannot use to classify people?
Yes. Section N 6.54 of the code prohibits using certain factors, alone or combined, as the full reason to refuse, cancel, non-renew, or stick someone in a certain rating class.
For which types of insurance?
This applies to auto, residential property up to 4 units, and residential personal property.
And the prohibited factors are?
Past criminal record, with narrow exceptions related to the risk. Physical, developmental, or past mental disability, age, marital status, sexual preference, or perceived moral character.
They can't use those as the only reason unless...
Unless the insurer has credible statistical data showing that factor equitably reflects differences in past or expected losses and expenses for that specific coverage.
Are there exceptions to these prohibitions?
A few. They can deny or renew for criminal offenses directly related to the insured risk. They can use legitimate statistical classifications. They can underwrite only specific risks. They can rate auto based on all drivers. And household size can be a factor.
And can they make you get a physical exam at your own cost?
No. Wisconsin law prohibits requiring applicants or insureds to get a physical exam at their own expense for coverage.
Okay. And the actual policy forms for P&C, do those need filing too?
Generally, yes. Any form, endorsement, rider that becomes part of the contract usually has to be filed with the OCI at least 30 days before use. Allows for review. Let's narrow the focus now specifically to property insurance. Wisconsin law actually dictates some required content for these policy forms.
So like standard clauses that have to be in your homeowners or fire policy here?
Yes. For certain types of properties, there are required contents. We won't list every single one for time, but generally this applies to policies covering seasonal dwellings.
Okay.
Owner-occupied multifamily buildings, up to 4 units, owner-occupied combined commercial residential properties, and owner-occupied places partially destroyed but ordered demolished.
What's not covered by these specific form requirements?
Usually doesn't apply to policies on outbuildings insured with the main dwelling, mobile homes, or property under construction, unless it's finished and owner-occupied.
Got it. Primarily owner-occupied residential and small mixed use. Now, domestic abuse situations and property insurance. Are there special rules if a claim arises from that, like if there's an intentional acts exclusion?
Yes, there's a key protection. If property damage is caused by abuse or domestic abuse, the insurer cannot deny the claim of an innocent insured.
Meaning someone who wasn't involved.
Right. Someone who didn't cooperate in, contribute to, or know about the abusive act beforehand. And the alleged abuser has to be criminally prosecuted for their actions related to the loss.
That's a really important safeguard. What about using or disclosing information about someone being a victim of domestic abuse? Are insurers restricted?
Absolutely. Insurers and their staff agents are legally restricted from using, disclosing, or transferring info indicating someone is or was a victim. That includes their phone number or address.
Are there exceptions?
Yes. For necessary health care, valid business like reinsurance, to their lawyers or medical underwriting staff under confidentiality agreements.
Uh-huh.
In response to legal process like a subpoena, a court, or OCI order, or when the insured applicant wants access to their own records.
Strict rules to protect privacy and safety. What if there's a dispute about the amount of a property loss and they go to appraisal? Does the court get involved?
Yes. If there's a dispute over the loss amount, either the insured or the insurer can apply to the court. The court is then required to appoint a disinterested, impartial appraiser to participate in the policy's appraisal process.
Working with the appraisers chosen by each side.
Exactly. To help reach a fair resolution on the disputed amount.
Good to know there's an impartial option. Liability policies often mention the insured's bankruptcy. What do those clauses typically say under Wisconsin law?
Every liability policy here must state that the insured's bankruptcy or insolvency does not diminish the insurer's liability to injured third parties.
So the insurer still has to pay?
Yes. The insurer can't use the bankruptcy as an excuse not to pay a covered claim. And if a third party gets a judgment against the bankrupt insured but can't collect,
they can sue the insurer directly.
Correct. They can take direct legal action against the insurer to recover the judgment amount up to the policy limits.
Important protection for injured people. What about required notice provisions in liability policies?
They have to include a provision saying that giving notice of a claim or suit to any authorized agent of the insurer in Wisconsin with enough info to identify the insured counts as proper notice to the company itself.
And what if notice is late? Does it automatically kill the claim?
Not necessarily. Failure to give notice within the policy's time frame doesn't invalidate the claim if it wasn't reasonably possible to give notice then, and notice was given as soon as reasonably possible afterwards.
Okay, reasonableness matters. Let's shift to auto liability policies specifically. Key required coverages.
Every policy issued or delivered here has to provide that the coverage for the named insured also applies to anyone else using the described vehicle with permission.
Permissive users.
Right, as long as it's used for purposes described in the policy. This also covers anyone legally responsible for the vehicle's use.
Can they limit that permission?
The policy can limit coverage to use with the named insured's permission or an adult household member's, excluding chauffeur servants, but they can't completely exclude permissive users.
So generally, if you let someone drive your car, they're covered. What about uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage? UMUM, mandatory.
For policies effective Nova 1, 2011 or later, covering vehicles registered garaged here and insuring against bodily injury liability. Yes. Uninsured motorist, UM coverage is required.
Minimum limits.
Minimum $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident, for damages you're legally entitled to recover from an uninsured driver.
An underinsured motorist, UIM.
That's different. Insurers are required to offer UIM coverage with minimum limits of at least $50,000 or $100.
Offer it, so you can reject it.
Yes. If a new policy is issued without UIM, the insurer must give you a separate written notice about its availability and a brief description, and you can reject it in writing.
So UM is required. UIM must be offered. Are there types of drivers or vehicle uses that policies cannot exclude from liability coverage?
Yes. Wisconsin law prohibits excluding coverage for people related by blood marriage adoption to the insured.
Okay.
Can't exclude the named insured or passengers, except on single rider motorcycles, mopeds. Can't exclude someone solely due to age if they're authorized to drive.
What about risky driving?
Can't exclude use for unlawful purposes, liquor transport violations, driving under the influence, or reckless driving just based on those acts themselves.
Interesting. Are any policy types exempt from requiring UMUIM and medical payments coverage?
Yes. Umbrella or excess liability policies providing at least $1 million in excess coverage are exempt.
Okay.
Also, commercial liability policies that only provide incidental coverage for non-owned vehicles are exempt.
But if those exempt policies do offer UM or MedPay,
then they have to provide at least the minimum limits required for non-exempt policies.
Got it. Can an insurer cancel or refuse auto insurance based on things like age, sex, race, or occupation?
No. Wisconsin law explicitly prohibits canceling, refusing to issue, or non-renewing auto insurance solely based on age, sex, residence, race, color, creed, religion, national origin, ancestry, marital status, or occupation.
Protected characteristics. What about using non-original parts for repairs after a claim? Non-OEM parts?
There are rules. If non-OEM aftermarket parts are used, the manufacturer's name or logo must be on the part and visible after installation.
Can the insurer force you to use them?
They cannot require you to use non-OEM parts without first giving you a specific written notice. That notice has to inform you of your right to choose OEM parts and state the insurer will only pay up to the cost of the non-OEM parts. Verbal notice needs a written follow-up.
Transparency and choice again. What about using odometer readings from emissions tests for setting rates?
Prohibited. Insurers cannot use that DOT odometer data obtained from emissions tests as a direct factor in setting or changing auto insurance rates or premiums.
But they can use it to investigate mileage claims.
Yes, they can use it for the limited purpose of investigating if reported mileage seems unusual.
Okay. Windshield repairs. Can the insurer tell you which shop to use?
No. Insurers are prohibited from requiring you to use a specific vendor or location for motor vehicle glass repair or replacement. Lists limiting choice are also prohibited. You choose the shop.
Good to know. Okay. What about parents' or sponsors' liability for minors driving?
In Wisconsin, if a minor, under 18, causes an accident through negligence or willful misconduct, the parents are responsible if they have custody and one signed the license application.
What if parents didn't sign or someone else sponsored?
Then the adult sponsor who did sign is responsible. They're jointly and severally liable with a minor for the damages caused.
So sponsoring a minor driver comes with real responsibility. And if an insurer cancels a policy that was certified as proof of financial responsibility, special notice needed.
Yes. They can't cancel or terminate that certified policy until at least 10 days after filing notice with the Wisconsin DOT Division of Motor Vehicles.
Any other restrictions?
They also cannot cancel a certified policy for non-payment of premium within the first 90 days after it was certified.
Okay, let's shift to a less common but interesting area.
Yeah.
Legal expense insurance. Basically insurance to help cover lawyer fees.
Right. Legal expense insurance. What exactly does a policy like that cover? Is it just like having a lawyer on retainer? Sort of. It's a contract where the insurer agrees to provide or reimburse you for specific legal services, usually for a set payment over a certain time. It doesn't matter who pays the premium, you, your employer, a union.
But it doesn't cover the legal defense you get with liability insurance?
Correct. That's considered incidental to the liability coverage itself, not true legal expense insurance.
Are there types of legal help plans that aren't considered formal legal expense insurance under the law?
Yes, several exceptions. Plans mainly for employees or union members covering work-related legal matters.
Okay.
Plans offered by genuine churches, co-ops, schools, credit unions, or employee groups, if their main purpose isn't insurance or legal aid, and they contract directly with lawyers for their members.
What else?
Plans where the annual cost is under $200. Plans where legal services, beyond basic advice docs, are charged at set or reduced rates that aren't way below market rates. Plans you can withdraw from without penalty. And certain plans filed with the commissioner where services are provided by plan members or attorneys under specific written agreements.
So quite a few arrangements fall outside the specific regulation. What about the rates for actual legal expense insurance policies? Any standards?
Yes, like other insurance, the rates cannot be unfairly discriminatory. They need to be based on sound actuarial principles and reflect the expected costs for similar risk groups.
Can insurers offer lower deviated rates for legal expense insurance?
Yes, but under specific conditions. They have to keep detailed records for at least 5 years showing how the deviated rate was developed, when it was effective, the risk location, why it was deviated, etc.
And they have to tell the commissioner first.
Yes, they need to provide prior notification to the commissioner before using a rate deviation program.
So flexibility, but with documentation. We briefly mentioned title insurance practices earlier. Is that related?
Not directly, though both involve legal elements. Title insurance has its own rules. Current law prohibits unfair marketing in title insurance by applying the general unfair marketing prohibitions from Chapter 628, like specifically prohibiting title insurers from giving freebies, benefits, services, equipment, office space to agents, lenders, etc., just to get referrals. The fees and premiums should relate directly to the title search, exam, and insurance provided. Now, for a really critical area, workers' compensation insurance. This system provides benefits to employees for work-related injuries or illnesses, basically on a no-fault basis.
Workers' comp. So if you get hurt on the job, this is the system that covers you.
That's exactly right. It's a comprehensive system where the employer is financially responsible for those work-related injury illnesses. Mm-hmm. And importantly, it's usually the exclusive remedy.
Meaning you generally can't sue your employer for the injury.
Correct. Workers' comp is typically the only path for recovery against the employer. The whole system is administered by the Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Workforce Development, DWD.
What's their role?
A key part is making sure private insurers and self-insured employers pay the required benefits promptly and correctly to injured workers. And remember, this is separate from health insurance. It only covers disability resulting from a work injury or illness.
Who counts as an employer under the law? Does every single business need coverage?
The definition is very broad. It includes the state and local governments, any private employer with three or more employees at any time.
Even small employers.
Yes, even those with fewer than three employees, if they pay wages of $500 or more in any calendar quarter. And farmers who employ six or more people for at least 20 days a year, the law specifies exactly when they become subject to the act.
And who is an employee? Are independent contractors covered?
Employees also broad. State, local personnel, police officers, anyone under a contract of hire, including minors, but usually excluding domestic servants, and those not in the employer's trade unless elected in. Volunteer firefighters count.
And independent contractors.
They are generally presumed to be employees, unless they meet all nine specific conditions listed in the statute, which is a high bar. Corporate officers are usually employees too, though officers of very small, closely held corporations can sometimes elect out.
So it sounds like the vast majority of workers in Wisconsin are covered.
That's the goal. Full-time, part-time, family members, minors, if legally employed, most corporate officers, they're generally included. Okay, let's talk about public adjusters. They play a distinct role representing the policyholder in the claims process.
Public adjusters, I've heard of them. They work for the insured, not the insurance company, right? What do they actually do?
Exactly. They work for the policyholder. A public adjusting service means acting on behalf of the insured for compensation to help prepare, file, and settle a first-party claim with their own insurer.
What does that involve?
It can be investigating the loss, interpreting the policy, preparing claim documents, negotiating with the company's adjuster about the value of the loss, damages, depreciation, basically applying the loss details to the policy to get a fair settlement for the insured. They're your advocate.
So if you have a big loss, you might hire one to help you navigate the claim. Are they regulated in Wisconsin?
Yes, under Chapter 629 of the statutes. Specifically, non-resident public adjusters must register with the OCI before working here.
What about Wisconsin residents?
For resident public adjusters, registration is currently optional. But even though it's voluntary to residents, if they do register, it shows up as a license in the OCI database.
Mm-hmm.
This can be really helpful for getting licensed or registered to work in other states that do have mandatory licensing for everyone. Helps with reciprocity.
Okay. So optional, but potentially useful. If you hire one, is there a contract, required terms?
Yes, a formal written contract is required. It has to include several key things for transparency.
Like what?
The public adjuster's info, name, addresses, residence business, phone, registration number if they have one, the insured's info, name, address, insurer, policy number, a description of the loss and location, the date and time the contract was signed, a statement that the adjuster is fully bonded as required.
How they get paid.
Clear disclosure of their compensation, following the statute. And really importantly, a clause telling the insured they have the right to void the contract within 5 business days by written notice, certified registered mail, or personal service.
5 days to change your mind.
Right. And the contract must also say the adjuster has to return anything of value received from the insured within 15 business days if the contract is voided. Finally, let's wrap up with a quick look at Wisconsin's risk-sharing plans. These are important safety nets for people and businesses who struggle to get coverage in the regular market.
Risk-sharing plans. So this is where insurers pool resources to cover high-risk individuals or properties.
That's the basic idea. Wisconsin has several. For auto insurance, there's the Wisconsin Automobile Insurance Plan, or WAIP.
For drivers who can't get coverage elsewhere.
Exactly. Agents helping applicants apply for WAIP have specific duties. They need to check if the applicant truly couldn't get voluntary coverage recently, within 60 days. Ensure the application is right. Submit the deposit premium.
Who does the agent represent? WAIP.
No. Crucially, the agent is legally considered the agent of the applicant, not WAP or the assigned insurer. The agent also needs to check eligibility, get the applicant's 3-year driving record from the DOT, and send the whole package to WAP.
So WAP is the auto safety net. Is there one for workers' comp too?
Yes, the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Insurance Pool. It's for employers who can't get workers' comp in the private market, often due to bad loss history.
Are the rates higher in the pool?
Interestingly, no. The rates are generally the same as they would be in the private market for similar risks. The Wisconsin Compensation Rating Bureau, WCRB, administers the pool.
And the agent's role?
Similar to WAIP. If private coverage isn't available, the agent assists the employer with the pool application, making sure it's complete with payroll info, deposit premium, etc. Again, the agent represents the applicant, the employer, not the pool or assigned insurer. And agents cannot bind coverage through the pool or backdate it. They need to know the pool rules in the WCRB handbook.
Okay, a safety net for employers needing workers' comp. What about basic property insurance, homeowners struggling to get covered?
That's where the Wisconsin Insurance Plan, or WIP, comes in. It's a nonprofit plan providing basic property coverage, fire, extended coverage, vandalism, burglary, and a modified homeowner's policy for qualified owners who can't get it voluntarily.
What's not covered?
Usually excludes manufacturers, farms, autos. All Wisconsin property insurers have to participate, and OCI supervises it.
Are there coverage limits?
Yes. The modified HO policy, for example, has a $200,000 dwelling limit, with standard percentages for other structures, contents, loss of use, plus $100,000 personal liability and $1,000 medical payments.
And the agent's role with WIP?
Assist the applicant, submit complete applications, follow plan rules. But they don't act as an agent for WIP. They can't bind coverage, alter policies, settle claims, or commit the plan. They're helping the applicant access the plan.
Got it. WIP for property. Lastly, what about liability for doctors and hospitals? Medical malpractice.
Yes, there's the Wisconsin Healthcare Liability Insurance Plan, or WHCLIP. It provides liability coverage for licensed Wisconsin medical professionals and entities, physicians, podiatrists, nurses, hospitals, public medical groups.
Who participates?
Most liability insurers in Wisconsin, except Town Mutuals. If WHCLIP loses money, the member insurers get assessed to cover the shortfall.
So another key mechanism ensuring necessary coverage is available, this time for healthcare providers. Well, that was certainly a deep dive. We've covered a massive amount of ground on Wisconsin insurance law using the Intermediaries Guide as our map. From the commissioner's powers to intermediary licensing, contract rules, different insurance types, and those crucial risk-sharing plans.
Absolutely. And you can really hear how detailed and intricate Wisconsin insurance law is. What we talked about today, it really just scratches the surface, giving hopefully a solid foundation. But these rules, they affect everyone, not just industry folks. They impact consumers and the whole insurance industry significantly.
Definitely a lot to digest. You know, it makes you wonder about specifics, like what kind of enforcement actions has the commissioner taken lately, or how has that interstate compact really changed product availability here, or even the nitty-gritty of workers' comp benefit calculations. Lots more to potentially explore.
For sure. And ultimately, looking at this framework, you really see that constant balancing act, don't you? Trying to protect consumers effectively while also allowing for a stable, healthy, and well-regulated insurance market to operate. It's about safeguarding people and businesses while keeping the industry sustainable.
A fascinating and complex balance indeed. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive today. Until next time, keep thinking and keep questioning.